Support for the Radio West podcast comes from Harmon's Grocery, committed to excellent service and friendly smiles. Your food is our passion.
Last Saturday at around 2 a.m., a gunman impersonating a police officer showed up at the home of Minnesota State Senator John Hoffman and his wife. He shot them both. They were critically wounded, but they have survived. And then he went to the home of Minnesota State Representative Melissa Hortman and her husband, and he shot and killed them both. The suspect, Vance Belter, reportedly had a list of political enemies. And just 4 hours later, Utah Senator Mike Lee took to X. He posted a photo of the suspect with the caption, "This is what happens when Marxists don't get their way." And then he followed it up with a dig at Minnesota's Democratic governor. "Nightmare on Walt Street," he wrote. The backlash came almost immediately. The Democratic senators from Minnesota called him out publicly into his face. So have other lawmakers and leaders. On The Daily Show, Jon Stewart called Lee's early morning posts a night of edgelord posting. On Tuesday, the senator deleted the posts, but he hasn't yet offered an apology. And the truth is, Senator Lee has been active online like this for a while now. Here's the Salt Lake Tribune reporter Robert Gerke.
So on the morning of March 10th, he wakes up and he starts posting.
"Who told this Ukrainian general this was a good strategy to insult President Trump?"
He's posting about USAID.
"In which part of USAID do you think the idea originated?"
Doge cuts.
"Why exactly was the Doge email frightening?"
He's posting about Donald Trump going after big law firms. He's trashing Democrats.
"Dems like green stuff, right? Trump's Greenland plan should be super bipartisan. If you can't handle people disagreeing with you without trying to silence and punish them, you might be a Democrat. Go home or go to jail. If you're here illegally, you're not welcome in the U.S. Has anyone done a wellness check on Joe Biden since January 20th? Radical, left-wing, criminal conspiracy afoot."
And by the end of the day, he had posted 343 posts.
"I don't drink coffee, but if I did, it'd be black for sure. For sure. For sure. For sure. For sure. For sure.
That's like every 2.5 minutes he's posting something. And it just falls into this pattern that we've seen from him. In the first 3 months of this year, he posted over 9,000 times. That's about every 15 minutes for the course of the day, assuming he never stops to eat, sleep, you know, spend time with his family, hug his kids, or do his job as a sitting U.S. senator. So this latest incident where he, you know, posted about these shootings in Minnesota just fits into that pattern that we've seen from him over the course of well over a year now. I think it speaks a little bit to Mike Lee. I think it speaks a little bit to our political climate. A situation where, you know, now you have to be the edgiest and most provocative. You have to be Marjorie Taylor Greene or Matt Gaetz or Mike Lee in order to break through the din and become a figure on the political scene. I think that's part of it. I think it served him well in that regard because we've seen this Twitter following that he's, you know, helped grow and nurtured since he created the account, grow up to over 600,000 people. And he's built that social media presence by, again, fitting into that, be more outlandish, be more outrageous, say things that are more provocative, say things that are edgier. But from a political standpoint, in a U.S. Senate that's evenly divided, you can be one of the 100 or you can stand out above those 100 and use that leverage that you've created with this following. If he tweets something, if he says, you know, call your senator or, you know, tell him that we need to pass the SAVE Act or whatever bill he's promoting that day, there are going to be people who call. It makes him, in some regards, a player on the Washington scene in a way that he otherwise might not be. I mean, the Senate has throughout history been renowned as the world's most deliberative body. And, you know, he is a member of that deliberative body that has this certain amount of gravitas. And during his time in the Senate, he's introduced 538 pieces of legislation. He's passed six, a couple land conveyance acts, named a post office, named a veterans center, and extended the expiration date on another law. Now, we should be clear that the way the Congress works, sometimes these standalone bills don't pass. They get lumped in. So there are other things that he's done in that time. But his focus, especially in recent years, seems to be more about being that spokesperson for the right, defender of Trump, a promoter of Elon Musk, a promoter of Mike Lee, and a promoter of, at times, right-wing conspiracy theories.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about the fallout from Senator Lee's online posts. And I should mention, we reached out to Senator Lee's office this week. We're hoping to ask him directly about them, but we haven't heard back. We wanted to understand just how the senator developed such a vocal and provocative presence on social media and how he ended up here. And that's what we'll do today. Let's go back to reporter Robert Gerke. When did Senator Mike Lee shift from being this constitutional conservative to playing this kind of online troll?
That's a really interesting question because you're right. Mike Lee came up as this respected constitutional scholar. His dad, Rex Lee, worked in the Reagan administration, was very well respected at Brigham Young University and in legal circles. And Mike sort of fashioned himself out of that. His brother Tom Lee was a Utah Supreme Court justice. Mike, it's not any secret, has had ambitions to be on the U.S. Supreme Court. Mm-hmm. And so he had modeled himself as sort of the intellectual heavyweight of the conservative movement. Then we saw the emergence of Trump, something that Mike Lee adamantly opposed. And I think it's worth noting that, you know, he was one of the most vocal opponents of Trump during the first run. And it suggested after the Access Hollywood tape came out that he should drop out of the race, called him an embarrassment to the party. You've talked to Tim Alberta about his piece about the sort of evolution or revolution of Mike Lee. He's become one of Trump's most vocal supporters now. And Trump has changed politics. It's now less about policy disagreements and debates and more about attack, disparage, and if the facts don't fit, make up new facts. And so Mike Lee kind of had been moving in that direction, but I think it really changed about 3 years ago. In July of 2022, he created this Based Mike Lee Twitter account. He did it with the encouragement of some other right-wing social media influencers, a guy named Benny Johnson, a couple others that later ended up getting tied into this Russia propaganda investigation. They said they didn't know that they were on the payroll for KGB, but they were doing things and promoting things that would help the Russians undermine the U.S. support for Ukraine. Mike created a social media account at that point, and
he called it, you said in your article, one part experiment and two parts dare.
Yeah, yeah. And you kind of get that sense from it. And from the start, he was out there kind of throwing bombs and saying things that, you know, if you worked in Senator Lee's press office, you might cringe a little bit when you read them, you know, because they're things that usually the messaging out of a Senate office is very refined and controlled and calculated and polished. This was none of that. And it hasn't been that since it was created.
So does that mean that his X posts, Twitter posts, are seen as separate from his work as a senator? Like, is this a side gig?
it's a side hustle, yeah.
Side hustle.
I mean, look, one of the big questions that Senator Lee or his office have refused to answer, and maybe you guys will have better luck than we do, is if he's posting all of these himself. The people I've talked to who are in a position to know say, to their knowledge, he does all of this himself. And so this is just his thoughts, his sort of unfiltered, unrefined thoughts that come pouring out, you know, sometimes in torrents. We saw it with this Minnesota thing. We saw him posting these attacks on leftists and Marxists and Tim Walz and all this. And then we saw a much more traditional statement come out of the press office saying, we extend our condolences, violence has no place, the type of thing that you would expect a member of the United States Senate to say. And so we as reporters have viewed this as sort of two separate mouthpieces. And sometimes they're speaking in harmony and sometimes they're not.
On The Daily Show this week, Jon Stewart called Lee an edgelord posting. Just to remind people, what is an edgelord?
Well, I'm an old man now, Doug. But I think, generally speaking, it's somebody who just churns out memes, you know, throws bombs, is as edgy as they can possibly be, and tries to, you know, troll. It's basically a troll, right? And it's doing it for the purpose of inciting people to, you know, get furious or to, you know, rally their supporters.
But that's your job. That's what you do. It's not. Well, I guess the question for me is, like, in this case, the initial idea in this particular case we're talking about was that the shooting of the Minnesota lawmakers was a Democratic plot in some way, that it was a hit ordered by Minnesota Governor Tim Walz. And the question is, does Mike Lee actually believe any of that stuff, or is it just designed for effect?
Yeah, it would be hard to crawl inside the senator's head and figure out how much of it he believes and how much of it he doesn't. But given the number of times that he's consistently promoted these conspiracy theories, it's hard to think that he's just doing this for attention. I don't know if he's that desperate for attention, because that's the other thing. Senators are powerful people. They have people following them around. They have staff. They have lobbyists who are kissing their butt all the time. They have all of these political supporters. They've got adoration. And so why is he out there looking for this much more, you know, this much more, you know, likes and retweets and kudos from his base? When we talk about the other things he's promoted in the past, I mean, he promoted conspiracy theories that the January 6th protesters were federal agents. You know, he reposted an obituary for Jimmy Carter when Jimmy Carter was still alive. I mean, things like this that you would expect somebody with his intellect and position to at least, you know, double check, or he should certainly know better. And so this Minnesota thing was not the first time he's done this. It fits into a pretty well-established pattern of what the types of things he posts since he joined Twitter in 2022.
I won't keep asking you to get inside his head and check his motivations here, but it does seem like, I mean, you've been looking at some of the social scientists who are writing about the effect that it has on a person to keep getting attention. I mean, it seems like this thing kind of builds on itself. The more provocative thing you say, the more attention it gets, the more that inspires you to keep going. Like, what can you say about that?
Most of the time I've written about this, I've written about it from, what does this do for Mike Lee politically? Yeah. What is the political dynamic of it? But I think there's been a lot of research done on how, when you get those likes and retweets and you see a tweet or a social media post go wild, it's a shot of dopamine in your brain, right? And you want more of that, and more and more and more. Plus, I think that the way that social media is designed, the algorithm is going to start pumping more and more of that into his phone, and also more of his posts into other people who read those. And so it's just going to kind of snowball on itself. And then you get more of that dopamine hit, more and more. Again, I am not a therapist, and I can't say that that is what is happening with Senator Lee in particular. But there's some well-established science that does drive, and a lot of the research has been done around young people, but, you know, adults' brains are, generally speaking, similar. And so I think there is a pretty compelling case to be made that is at least part of what is driving this. Plus, again, political power is also an aphrodisiac, and I think, you know, it sort of builds on itself.
So set aside dopamine hits for a minute, and set aside, you know, the desire for sort of political influence. How much money is he making on all of this?
Well, that's a really interesting question. And the short answer is, right now, we don't know. Back in 2023, Twitter began paying its content creators based on how many ads get seen, basically, on the back end of their posts. So there was potential for money to start being made then for those blue check users, the premium Twitter users.
Yeah.
So Mike Lee, for his 2024 personal financial disclosure, filed for an extension. Normally, we would have seen that last month. We won't see it potentially until, I believe, September. And so right now, we don't have a very good answer for that. But given the, you know, again, 2.3 billion engagements with people, the likes and retweets, the number of followers he's got, it's entirely possible that we're talking tens of thousands of dollars here that he could be making off of these Twitter posts. And so, you know, I don't think that Senator Lee is impoverished. Senators make okay money, not great money. But, you know, there is at least the potential there that he's making a considerable chunk of change by posting this stuff and getting – and again, it has that perverse incentive, right? If you're getting paid by how much outrage and fury you can generate and how, you know, much you can upset people or energize people, then, you know, it's just another of one of several incentives for him to kind of keep doing this and going down this road.
Robert, do you think he's good at it? And I'm not sure even how you measure that. It's such a kind of subjective sort of way of analyzing something like that. But it seems like you have to have some kind of – it's not charisma, I guess, but wit or cunning or incisiveness or something to get so many people to respond.
The funny thing is people have a perception of Mike Lee that he is – well – I've known him for more than two decades, and he does have a sense of humor. So he is fairly clever. He can tell a joke. He can think on his feet. And people may not want to hear that, but it's true. So I think in that regard, he's good at it. He's good at it in the sense that he has built these relationships with people like Elon Musk, who have a huge, you know, profile, and people like Libs of TikTok, which is an account that has a big right-wing following. He'll piggyback on some of their stuff. They'll amplify each other. People like Benny Johnson, they'll amplify each other. And then he picks these issues du jour that are currently trending and in the Fox News InfoWars world and piggybacks on that. So I think he has a good sense of what is generating outrage at that moment. And he has a network of people who they amplify each other's posts and interact with each other, and it generates more heat. And yeah, sometimes he posts stuff that is kind of clever. He posted this whole thread earlier this year called Letters of Marque, which was going to be – he was trying to convince the president to issue letters of marque, which would allow him to deport people. As it was used against pirates during the 1800s. He posted this whole thread called Letters of Marque, which was this sort of fake romance novel set in, you know, the Constitutional Convention era. And he had this little AI cover for it. And it's just, it's, look, I mean, it's nerdy. It's kind of right in Mike Lee's wheelhouse, right? It's kind of nerdy, very political, a little pointed, but also at least mildly entertaining for some of the people who might follow it.
It makes me wonder if you have to tweet at Donald Trump.
Yeah.
Do you actually have access to the president? Like, what's his relationship like with Donald Trump? I mean, I think there were some questions early on about, gosh, will Mike Lee be attorney general?
Yeah.
Is he on the short list for Supreme Court? Now, Trump has run afoul with the Federalist Society. Mike Lee's a big Federalist guy. Like, what do we know about the relationship between Trump and Mike Lee?
Yeah, obviously going from the turbulent beginning, you know, it has improved considerably. There was discussion that he was on the short list for the Supreme Court vacancy that Amy Coney Barrett got. Lee is one of the most reliable supporters of the president. I don't think – I mean, we have to keep in mind tweeting at the president doesn't actually do much for you because he's not on X. He's on his own Truth Social platform.
Yeah.
You know, Mike Lee has the president's phone number. We know that because on January 6th, the president accidentally called Mike Lee. So I think that, you know, they do have a relationship. The president knows that Mike Lee is going to be a reliable supporter on pretty much everything he does. And he's kind of a bulldog, too. And so I think that their relationship is symbiotic in a way. The president can rely on Lee, and Lee can get more attention and likes and retweets from the president. So I think the president can count on Mike Lee as a supporter at all times. How much the president supports Mike Lee is another question, right?
Right.
Mike Lee did not get the Supreme Court nomination that he wanted so badly. He did not get the attorney general post, you know. And so does the president carry a grudge for the criticism that Lee heaped on him before? It was interesting during this past election cycle in 2024, Senator Lee was very much out there endorsing several candidates for the Republican nomination. Trump came in and endorsed other candidates. The Trump candidates, by and large, you know, did better. The Celeste Molloy endorsement is a good example of that, where they ended up on kind of different sides on these candidates. It's odd for the president to get involved in a Utah Republican nomination fight, but, you know, it made a big difference for Celeste Molloy. And it was an example of where the president and Mike Lee were politically not aligned and on different sides.
Robert Gerke. He's a politics reporter for the Salt Lake Tribune. We have links to his recent articles about Senator Lee on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about Utah Senator Mike Lee and the fallout from his inflammatory posts after the deadly attacks in Minnesota. Lee has been leaning into the far-right online world for a while now, firing up the outrage merchants and the right-wing culture warriors. And we're trying to explain this strange transformation from him being this conservative scholar to now this online edgelord. I should mention, we reached out to Senator Lee's office to ask for an interview or a statement. We haven't heard back. We've been talking with the Salt Lake Tribune reporter, Robert Gerke. What was the reaction? How do you describe the reaction to – because Mike Lee has ended up in the national headlines. It's a conversation right now. It's been described in all kinds of ways. Vile has been one of them. What has the reaction been?
Yeah, I mean, for people who have followed Mike Lee's Twitter account on a regular basis, it wasn't necessarily shocking. Mm-hmm. But this definitely did make national headlines because you had his colleagues in Tina Smith and Amy Klobuchar not really holding back on their disgust with this. You had Republican state lawmakers in Minnesota who, you know, are aligned with him politically perhaps, but thought that this was way over the line. The letter that Senator Smith's deputy chief of staff wrote to him was very pointed, where he said, you know, have you no decency? There was a line in there about the pain he's caused and the lives he's impacted for this family who lost their parents. Is this a win for Team Lee? Is this a good day for your office? Have you no decency? It was a scathing letter. I don't think that a letter from a deputy chief of staff is even going to register for Senator Lee, but I think the criticism from his colleagues probably does. And we saw him take down some of those posts, not all of them, but some of them. And it made national news. Like you mentioned, the Jon Stewart called him out for it, and he was on CNN. He was everywhere. And not in the way that you want to be getting attention for your political service.
Well, right? That's the question then, though. Does Mike Lee perceive this as having gone too far? Does he see it as a kind of a misstep in any way, as far as we can tell?
Well, I mean, you probably saw the video of him refusing to answer reporters' questions about it. He's not issued an apology. He's not tweeted an apology publicly. I mean, maybe he's apologized to people privately, but
so we have no sense of whether or not he thinks it crossed a line of decency.
I mean, I think we have a sense that he acknowledges that maybe it went too far and that it hurt some people because he did take some of it down. But it isn't going to stop him because we've seen him do this sort of stuff before where he gets called out for things and has to take it down. Not perhaps to this scale or this level, but, you know, I mean, it's one of those things that he's built this reputation by doing this. And I would be very surprised if it even impacts the way he interacts on Twitter or X in the future at all.
When Mike Lee sends out an X post, a Twitter post, is he at all speaking to Utahns? He has a constituency.
Yeah. I mean,
he has a base.
Yeah. So political scientists I've talked to about this say that he has multiple audiences when he's posting on X. Some of it is Utahns. But one of the things that I noticed when I was looking at the 23,000 tweets that he's posted since he created the account, very few of them mention Utah or Utah issues. You know, sometimes he does. Sometimes he talks about this proposal he has to sell off public land to build affordable housing or build housing or build on, you know, so sometimes he does. But and some of the issues he talks about, the SAVE Act, voter identification legislation that he's been promoting, that resonates in Utah as well, I think. But by and large, a lot of this stuff is not Utah related. You know, he's talking about making Greenland the 51st state, and he's talking about, you know, defunding Ukrainian, our support for Ukraine, and defunding NPR and PBS and all of this. There are people in Utah who care about that, but it's not Utah-specific issues. So there are multiple audiences. The larger audience, if you're talking to 600,000 people on Twitter, the larger audience is not going to be focused on Utah-related issues. They're not going to be his constituents. And those constituents he is speaking to, or those constituents who care about those issues, probably already support him anyway.
Because it gets to the question of what exactly is he trying to accomplish with all of this? That is, what are his aspirations? And the first question is, will he run again?
Yeah.
In which case you'd say, well, his aspirations are political. But the other thing is, does he just want to be an influencer? Does he just want to be a kind of professional edgelord, find some money as a, I don't know, a pundit on Fox News? You can make decent money at that. Does he, positioning himself for influence in the MAGA world generally? Start with the question, will he run again? Do we know?
We don't know. But when Senator Lee ran for office in 2010, he was one of these people who supported term limits at the time. Now, he said he's not going to unilaterally limit his own terms. He would like to see everybody have term limits. He was critical of Orrin Hatch when he thought Orrin Hatch stayed around too long. Mm. So when he's up for reelection again in 2028, he'll have been in the Senate for 18 years. I would be surprised if he runs again, frankly, because at that point he's signing on for 24 full years. He's going to, you know, up through 2034. And I think there are other things that he wants to do. I mean, obviously there are external factors that if he gets the nomination for the U.S. Supreme Court, obviously he's not going to run again. But barring that, I would be surprised if he does run again. So what does that mean? Like, is Twitter helping him build that next, you know, landing spot? In some ways, yes. Look, if he's going to want to go practice law or, you know, potentially lobby, the Twitter following isn't helping him. But, you know, there's also this whole right-wing media world now where you see people like Jason Chaffetz on Fox News, or, you know, who kind of landed at Fox News by being vocal and outspoken and a public face and articulate and able to, you know, engage and do battle on some of the issues. You see, you know, Matt Gaetz, he's now hosting a conservative news program, you know, and so I think there is this whole new conservative media world where somebody like Senator Lee could walk out the door with a following that then looks pretty attractive to One America News Network or Fox News or somebody like that. Or, you know, he could follow sort of the Glenn Beck route and build his own media empire. You know, that's something that you can do once you have a devoted, you know, conservative following that he's building day by day by day. So obviously it has opened a door for him that probably wasn't there when he was the wonky constitutional scholar guy, and created a potential for him to, you know, springboard if he decides he's not going to run again in 2028.
Here's a question that gets at the moment we're in politically and maybe even says something about tolerance of Utah voters, even conservative Utah voters, to the kind of rhetoric you're hearing from Mike Lee. If he ran again, would he get elected?
Yeah, I always bet on the incumbent because they have so many advantages. He's got a built-in base. He's still wildly popular among the delegates, although they kind of turned on him a little bit at this last convention when he supported Rob Axon. Probably getting a little down in the weeds, but Rob Axon was running for re-election as state party chairman against Phil Lyman. Axon is a former Lee staffer, so it made sense that Lee came out and endorsed Axon. But the Lyman wing of the Republican delegates called him a sellout. He's coined this whole phrase uniparty, which is, you know, Republicans not being Republican enough. But I think by and large, he's still probably the most popular figure in that circle of the Republican Party among the delegates. So if he runs again, I think he would get the nomination without much trouble. There's not really anybody who could step in and challenge him. And we saw Democrats probably shoot their best shot at him in 2022 when they decided to get behind Evan McMullen. What we also saw then, though, is that Evan ran a fairly tight race with Senator Lee. And I think that kind of points to what you're getting at in the question, is that there is this undercurrent of moderate Republicans and independents who see this kind of diatribe from Senator Lee on social media and see the how much he's doing it. Like I was kind of shocked when I was looking at his numbers from last year. I took the three other most sort of outspoken political social media users I could, Democrat Nate Bluin, Governor Spencer Cox, and Senator Todd Weiler. The three of them combined were tweeting less than Mike Lee. And so, you know, they see how much he's doing and it's like, wait, is this guy doing his job? They look at the tone and the tenor and the rhetoric. It's abrasive. It's very Trumpian. And it kind of doesn't sit well with some of these people. And I've heard from a lot of these people who are kind of fed up with it. They don't want to say it out loud, but, you know, they kind of whisper in your ear. These are Republicans. Some of them are lawmakers, frankly, who are disgusted by what he's doing. And so he does run a risk, I think, of wearing out his welcome in some regard. But I think if he decides to run again, he overcomes that. He can raise $9, $10 million, $12 million, can use this social media following that he's created to raise that money if he needs to. And I think if he wants to run for re-election in 2028, he's safe. If he has other aspirations, then I guess the following helps him there too.
It's been such an interesting transition for the senator, as we were talking about at the beginning, from this sort of constitutional scholar to now this edgelord on the internet. Here's the final question. Is this just who Mike Lee is now?
I think one of the real interesting things about Tim Alberta's piece on Mike Lee is I don't know if Mike Lee knows who Mike Lee is. I think that was the biggest takeaway from it. I think he aspired so long to be a respected legal mind like his dad, and now he aspires to be a respected and feared and adored figure like Donald Trump. I'm not sure who he is, you know? I mean, he wants that approval. He wanted the approval from his father and from his political followers, and he wanted to be respected in that regard. It's hard to think of people who should have more respect and have more adoration than a United States senator. But it seems like it's not enough. I don't think this is going away, this element of his Twitter persona. I think it's kind of telling because in the midst of posting these posts about Minnesota, he did post this Father's Day post about how much he misses his dad. And so I think that's the kind of the duality there. Is he this constitutional respected scholar, which he still has those chops, or is he now the edgelord that Jon Stewart and others see him as on social media?
Robert Gerke, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Robert Gerke with the Salt Lake Tribune. We have links to his recent articles about Senator Lee on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take another break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Support for the Radio West podcast comes from Harmon's Grocery, committed to excellent service and friendly smiles. Your food is our passion.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. So today in the program, we've been asking these questions about Utah Senator Mike Lee's inflammatory online posts after the killing of a Minnesota state lawmaker and her husband last Saturday. They're the same kinds of questions that we asked the journalist Tim Alberta last fall. In a piece for The Atlantic magazine, Alberta was trying to work out what he described as the impossible symmetry of Senator Lee's once fervid opposition to Donald Trump and his now combative online persona. Alberta said it was as if Ned Flanders became a 4chan troll.
Yeah, I think in the case of Lee, someone who was always viewed as kind of a choir boy, to see him now trafficking on pretty much a daily basis in really crude conspiracy theories, and when he's, you know, allying himself with the likes of Charlie Kirk and Benny Johnson and Donald Trump Jr., and using language both online and in person occasionally, even, I've been told, that is just completely alien, not just to Lee, but to his social circles, to the LDS Church, to sort of his entire, the entire ecosystem, politically, culturally, sociologically, that produced Mike Lee, bears no resemblance to the ecosystem that he now inhabits.
You say for Mike Lee, this relationship with Donald Trump, it begins as this kind of transactional alliance. But you say it soon became personal.
I think the thing that has to be understood about Senator Lee is that when he came to Washington in 2010, he was really shunned. He really didn't make many friends. He didn't immediately have the outsized ambition that to run for president like some of his colleagues did. So he kind of came to Washington as a little bit of a man without a country. And I think that he learned after a little while that that was really a lousy way to exist in our increasingly tribal political world. And I think that he sort of, first in latching on to Ted Cruz and becoming sort of the Robin to his Batman, and then ultimately with Donald Trump, and now with the sort of MAGA subculture that surrounds Donald Trump, I think Lee had been searching for a sense of belonging, politically speaking. Mm. And I think that in a really sort of unexpected and ironic way, he is now found it just in the unlikeliest of places.
Let's talk about his father, Rex Lee. You describe him as a giant of the conservative legal movement. It seems as though just beyond his brilliance, the thing that stood out for you about Rex Lee was his independence and this deep sense of integrity about what he saw were the kind of broad interests of the nation. Talk about Rex Lee and who he is, and then we'll get to the sort of the influence on his son.
Of course. So Rex Lee is in many ways, almost next to his close friend Antonin Scalia, almost like a founding father of the conservative legal movement, and someone who is just revered by many of his contemporaries on the courts and many of the students he taught, the judges who in front of whom he argued cases. He served for a little over 4 years as Solicitor General to Ronald Reagan from 1981 through 1984. And really, Rex Lee compiled what is agreed to be one of the most, if not the most, impressive records arguing in front of the Supreme Court as any litigator that Washington had ever seen. We struggled in our fact-checking department to try to compare apples to apples, so ultimately we omitted a few of the statistics that we were working with. But based on a lot of the research we were doing, he may very well have compiled the most impressive litigation record in front of the court that of any solicitor general. So he was a brilliant, brilliant legal mind. So he is someone whose legal genius was sort of universally observed and respected. But to your point, the thing that really set apart Rex Lee, the thing that everyone talks about, everyone writes about, wherever you go for a remembrance of Rex Lee, you come across these really remarkable observations of his honesty, of his decency, and of his integrity, that word that you used. In fact, when he was eulogized after his very early death, he was just 61 years old when he succumbed to a long fight with cancer. And when he was eulogized, it was pretty notable that there was a Republican Supreme Court appointee and a Democrat Supreme Court appointee who both eulogized him at his funeral. And in fact, it was the Democratic appointee who eulogized Rex Lee and called him, quote, the epitome of integrity. And I think that description is consistent with everything you find about the man, that in fact, he spent much of his time as Solicitor General doing battle with the Reagan administration because he did not appreciate and did not find appropriate the political pressure that they were putting on him as Solicitor General, feeling like they were treating him as though he was some sort of political flunky rather than being the top litigator for the federal government. And he ultimately wound up quitting because of that political pressure. And he gave this famous quote where he said, "I'm the Solicitor General, not the pamphleteer general." And so there was this degree of intellectual and ideological and political independence that helped to carve out his reputation as something much more than just a sort of lion of the conservative legal movement.
How does Mike Lee talk about his father
and about his sense of independence and integrity? Because he must bristle at the idea that maybe seems implied with that question that, you know, you're no Rex Lee. You're not like your father. What does he react that way?
Well, you know, it's interesting. It's very clear that Senator Lee idolized his father and idolizes him still.
Yeah.
And, you know, when we would discuss him, the senator would speak sort of very wistfully about his father and about how his father had sort of set a bar that he himself will never clear. And I think there's a humanity there that was really striking to me, that this is someone in Mike Lee for whom the ghost of his father looms very large in his life. To lose him at a very young age and to, I think, wrestle often, as he told me he does, with how his father might be thinking about the sort of moment that we're living through now. And of course, to be wrestling with that against a backdrop of a lot of your one-time friends and allies sort of calling you out and criticizing you, saying that you have given in, that you are guilty of doing exactly the thing that your dad never did, which was sort of caving to political pressure and turning into this sort of tribal political machine player. And you know, I think that probably weighs on him a great deal. And it's hard to know what he's thinking in his private most moments, because I noticed on a few occasions he would sort of catch himself and kind of get his guard back up. But it was certainly apparent in our conversations that it does weigh on him.
You write that Senator Lee saw his father in the, as you say, in the realm of the powerful and profound, and that he found himself wanting to be a part of that. Did Senator Lee know what that meant when he was young, necessarily at first? Like, I want to be a part of this, but because it seems like this is what you write about. Because he could have gone in the same way that his brother went, and that is into constitutional law and becoming a judge. But he picked another. So talk a little bit about how he was thinking about, how he was influenced about what he was seeing in the, you know, in the powerful people that his father, you know, knew, and how that influenced what he became.
So let's go back in time here, because, you know, Mike Lee moves when he is a very young man. He's sort of just entering his adolescence, his preteen years. He moves to Washington, D.C., to the suburbs, I should say, of Washington, D.C., just outside of the district, in a very wealthy area where his neighbors and his classmates, everybody who he spends time around, they're all, you know, everyone is a congressman or a diplomat, yeah, or a K Street lobbyist, somebody powerful, and their kids are all raised in this milieu together. And so I think Senator Lee, from a young age, is observing all of this, and he sees the power and the prestige, the influence, and, you know, he talks with me a little bit about this, that he didn't know exactly what it was, but he knew he was pretty compelled by it and he was pretty intrigued by it. And, you know, and then later on in life, I didn't even really have the time or space to get into this in the piece, but, you know, he winds up running for student body president, or the sort of equivalent position as an undergraduate at BYU.
Right.
And then you talk with folks who knew him in those undergraduate years, and then obviously when he's in law school, and the consistent answer you're getting from them is that they both knew he wanted to be in the mix, that he wanted to be a part of this world of sort of, you know, political intrigue, but that he didn't exactly know how to do it or didn't know exactly where he was going to fit. And, you know, there's really this inflection point early in his law school career that I write about where, to the degree that a young Mike Lee wanted to try to follow in the footsteps of his father and then his older brother, Thomas, who's sort of regarded as a legal prodigy in his own right, that path was foreclosed upon relatively early when Mike Lee failed in his first attempt to qualify for the BYU Law Review.
Right.
And just for those who are not steeped in law school nuance, this was really a devastating blow, because effectively anyone who wants to earn really prestigious clerkships and go straight from law school to working in the federal court system in some capacity, you need to get on Law Review, and you really need to get on it and spend 2 years on it, the maximum of your second and third year. Well, going into his second year, he failed. And then going into his third year, he failed in the sense that he was not in the top 10% of his class.
Yeah.
He did wind up writing an essay that allowed him to write for the Law Review as a staff member. But in talking with a lot of people at the time, they all came back to the same conclusion. And again, many of these are people who like Mike Lee quite a lot. They said, you know, Mike was a good student, but not a great student. He was he was going to be a good lawyer, but never a great lawyer. He was not his dad. He was not his brother. And I think that he knew that. That seemed to be the overwhelming consensus, is that he himself, as a young man, kind of understood some of the limitations that existed there, and that sooner or later, he was going to have to try to strike out on his own, maybe doing something else, and that politics could be that off-ramp from the legal world.
So he could have chosen the path of conservative scholar of the Constitution. Instead, his priorities shifted, you mentioned, so he becomes more interested in, as you say, partisan politics. Why do you think he chose politics?
You know, to spend time around the man is to see someone who is kind of a natural in many ways. And again, I write about this in the piece, even while on the one hand, he is turned into this sort of online MAGA troll caricature, he is simultaneously, when you spend time with him in person, very warm, very solicitous and generous with his time and can be very thoughtful. And so you can see how the skill set was always there. In fact, I remember talking with a couple of his colleagues from the Law Review who were in his class, and they said that he was a guy who just like always knew how to like shake a hand and kiss a baby, and just had these sort of natural political skills that many of them, as kind of law school nerds, didn't really have. That's kind of the mark of any really good retail politician, someone who can kind of walk into a room full of strangers and suddenly make them all feel like they're old chums. And so Lee has some of that. I think he also was sort of, I think he was, he became a little bit seduced by the platform that it would provide. Because if you listen to some of the stories told about the years before he went into politics himself, running for Senate in 2010, he had worked for Governor John Huntsman as his general counsel, and he was sort of traveling the state and getting to know a lot of these Republican power players and sort of finding his way in partisan politics. And by all accounts, he really loved it and was really like enamored of it in a way that I think kind of tipped his hand early. A number of people told me that by the time he wound up running for Senate a couple of years later, that they were not at all surprised, because they could sort of see that he'd been bitten by the political bug.
You point out in the piece the idea that nothing has changed about Mike Lee is the least satisfying and the most revealing. So what do you think happened? Did you come to any kind of conclusion? What happened to Mike Lee to make him turn?
The Republican Party has changed in really historic, significant ways. And I think in order to keep a seat at the table, Mike Lee recognized that he had to change with it. He saw what happened to friends of his, people like Jeff Flake in the Senate or Justin Amash in the House of Representatives. He saw that their continued opposition to Trump and their convictions cost them their careers. And I think in the case of Mike Lee, he values his career. He values this influence that he has. And I also think there's a part of him that just really was desperate to have an identity and a following and a brand that was all to his own. He saw a chance, perhaps, with the MAGA movement to kind of carve out his own niche. And he has. If you look at these alliances that he's built with Elon Musk and others, when you look at his social media following, when you look at the sort of celebrity that he's created for himself on the far right, there's no question that he has kind of achieved this thing that he always wanted. The only question is, at what cost?
Tim Alberta. He's a staff writer for The Atlantic. He joined us last fall for a conversation about his piece, Why Mike Lee Folded. We'll put links to that article and to our conversation on our website, radiowest.org. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. You can find us on YouTube at KUER90.1 or Instagram at Radio West, or you can email us at radiowest@kuer.org. The program is produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. Carrie Watson is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.